Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, from the entertainment realm to higher education, political activists are complaining that we live in cancel culture. But what exactly is cancel culture? And what is its impact on the classroom and in the democracy? Doug Becker explores with the author of a new book that addresses the issue.
I'm Doug Becker. As universities prepare to celebrate their graduating classes this year, we turn attention to the role of free speech and discourse in higher education. Protests against certain speakers and against some discourses have faced backlash, really across the political spectrum. For instance, in Florida, state officials led largely by Governor Ron DeSantis have sought to cleanse history of many of its discourses, notably about atrocities committed throughout American history. On other campuses, speakers representing hate speech, discourses of disempowerment, or discourses that are unpopular across many of the student groups have faced protests and demands that invitations to speak be revoked. What does this mean, both for free speech as well as democratization in the United States? What impact does it have on the pedagogy, the teaching of students, and our interests in knowledge or the university's epistemological expectations? Well, today, our guest has written a new book on precisely these issues. Sigal Ben-Poroff is a professor of education at the University of Pennsylvania. She also holds secondary appointments in the departments of political science and philosophy. The book is called Cancel Wars: How Universities Can Foster Free Speech, Promote Inclusion, and Renew Democracy. Professor Ben-Poroff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
So the book certainly, seems to suggest there's numerous areas where these so-called cancel wars and cancel culture have had an impact. But sort of the two main areas that I drew from this is first on broadly the question of democracy, and secondly, the question of just academic inquiry and academic discourses. Let's focus on the first one first. What exactly have been the impacts on democracy that there's been this pushback on certain types of discourses?
Well, this is really the core question here, Doug, and so I'm glad we're starting with that. I would say that there is a reverberation of these issues or a feedback loop between the cancellation of speech on the one hand and the restriction restriction on what is acceptable and what is permissible within our discourse. And on the other hand, our democratic culture. So democracy really depends on not just institutional structures, right, or processes, which are, of course, very important, the separation of branches and checks and balances and elections. But democracy really also depends on a democratic culture and on a commitment by citizens to participate in ways that are democratically supportive or permissible or enhancing. And so I really think that we are seeing here both an erosion of democracy and an erosion of the boundaries of discourse, and they are feeding each other. I don't think we can really mark a causation, right? We started being less accepting of unpopular speech, and here it is, democracy is eroding, right? Or vice versa. I really think that these are a part of the same phenomenon, which of course has a lot to do with the particular form of polarization that we and many other countries are experiencing right now, the mistrust or distrust of democratic institutions, right? So these are sort of like bigger processes, and our conversation about speech and our acceptance or tolerance for transgressive speech or unpopular speech or simply speech we disagree with is really caught up in this same cycle.
One of the themes that runs through the book is a question about respect for speech. The idea that we're not engaging speech that we find distasteful seems to be at the core here. That I know as an academic, one of the greatest pieces of respect you can give for anything that's been written or spoken is to take the time to counter it if you disagree with it. So ultimately, is this really at its core? But the challenge here is that both sides are showing a profound lack of respect for one another and their arguments by canceling each other.
That's a really useful way of putting it, Doug. I think what we are seeing is that both sides, as you are noting, are lacking respect for each other. We are seeing this tendency escalate with what some researchers call affective polarization or ideological contempt, right? So we are seeing a strong set of negative emotions towards people who hold the other ideology, right? So progressive and conservative partisans are both experiencing an escalation of their negative emotions towards the other side, and with it, a significant loss of trust in the capacity of the other side to engage open-mindedly, to engage in good faith debate, to be smart enough to understand different perspectives than their own, right? So each side is making very negative assumptions about the other side. And we are seeing this really feed this lack of trust or loss of trust. And therefore, you know, if you are saying something that I disagree with, and I already have a lot of background assumptions, negative assumptions about you, because I think you're on the other side of the ideological map, then of course the reasonable thing for me in this circumstance is to shut you up rather than to listen to you or try to counter what you're saying, because I'm assuming that you're actually not trying to engage in an argument or to participate in a discussion. I'm assuming that you're not respecting me, right? In this construction, right? And therefore, it makes sense for me to disengage from you, not to listen or to make sure that you can't speak, right? And so all of this, of course, under the assumption that we are speaking on two sides of the ideological divide. But even sometimes, if I think that the two of us or imaginary us, right, are on the same side, but we have a small disagreement, because under these circumstances, I have reason to worry so much that people who disagree with me, hate me, want to hurt me, are acting in bad faith, etc., then if you are even, you know, one step aside from me, I have reason to demand of you, right, that you fall back to toe the party line, that you come back into the fold, that you don't have any even slightly different views that you are willing to express, because that puts me at risk, right? Maybe you are one of them. You're not one of us. Why are you standing next to me if you're not 100% on the same page? And so I think that the loss or reduction of respect for divergent speech, for speech that expresses disagreement, is really a result of this escalation of negative emotions, that part of which is really the disrespect for diverse opinions, both within my camp and within the camp that I would see as the opposite side.
The sentiment, I completely understand that we need to be talking with one another. Something that I always like to highlight is I like a lot less debate and a lot more discourse and conversation. But this isn't new. I know a number of the cases, you know, you highlighted are relatively recent, but I'm thinking back to in the 80s, when David Duke, for example, was nominated for governor of Louisiana, and a reminder that what he represented, this extreme form of racism and fascism that he represented, had been canceled in many ways. I guess ultimately, then my question is, how far do we go to accommodate certain types of speech if we're venturing into areas like hate speech and ad hominem types of arguments, in particular, if they're involving things like racial epithets or just, you know, horrific types of arguments that really do demean and dehumanize certain populations?
Great. So I think when you say how far do we go, it really matters where the conversation is taking place and with whom, right? So I think we have a clear answer for this question, or relatively clear answer, in the legal domain. In the United States, these types of hateful rhetorics and hurtful expression and sometimes hate-based and bigoted opinions are opinions, right? Not conduct, but opinions are protected by the First Amendment. And so when we are speaking in the public sphere, in the media, you know, or in casual conversation, we are allowed to voice our opinions even when they are reflective of bigoted views or hurtful, et cetera, views. On the other hand, I think on college campuses and definitely in classrooms, we have reason to develop and enforce different norms. Now, you and I, Doug, are both teaching, and a lot of our listeners probably are instructors or teachers. We can develop our own norms, right? You can say, in my classroom, we speak like this, and I think that's not my thing. I have a different set of norms, and I think that's acceptable. You know, we don't need to enforce a shared set of norms, not about the form of participation, right? How do we speak to each other? And also not about the content in the way that, as you noted, some governors are trying to do now, right? In this state, we don't talk about this topic, or we don't mention these parts of history. I think that's inappropriate. I think, you know, professors and teachers, instructors need to be trusted with how they run their classes. But I do think that the boundaries that we create beyond what is appropriate for our different disciplines and, you know, classrooms and the age of our students and whatever other considerations that we make or that we decide to have. What is really important is to keep in mind that a learning community like a classroom or a campus depends on the sense of a ability to participate that everyone has to feel. So I'm going into feelings here, right? But I do mean that we need to create a climate where everyone knows that they are welcome to join the conversation. And when we do that, then we can have a rich conversation, because we are not only just nominally protecting formally, right, by rule. Oh, we don't censor here. We are always, you know, allowing everyone to speak, but we are allowing such hateful forms or disrespectful or aggressive forms of expression that some people choose to never participate, and so we'll never hear from them, but we didn't censor them, so we're fine. That might be okay for the public sphere. I don't love it, but I think that's how we operate. But it's not okay for the classroom. In our classrooms, it's our responsibility as instructors to make sure that people know that their voice and opinion is welcome. And we have to create the norms that really make this clear. And so where do we draw the line? It might be different with different student populations and different, as I said, ages or disciplines that we teach. It's different in the chemistry lab than it is in an intro to, I don't know what, English literature. But the driving principle has to be a principle of epistemic equality, meaning the understanding that everyone is in effect able to have their voices heard and be listened to.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing cancel culture, cancel wars, freedom of speech on college campuses and across the political universe. We are interviewing an author, Sigal Ben-Porath of the University of Pennsylvania, who's written a new book, Cancel Wars, How Universities Can Foster Free Speech, Promote Inclusion, and Renew Democracy. So Now we're talking a bit more about epistemology, talking a bit more about knowledge and the way the impact these ideas have on the development of knowledge. And I'm reminded of John Stuart Mill's famous argument for free speech, that if we're stifling speech, we might be stifling truth, or we might be stifling some form of knowledge. And so ultimately, you have a section in the book, and actually it cuts across both the university level and K through 12, about media literacy, critical analysis, you know, of media, and the importance of having narrative. You had a story about a student who had advanced an argument that was about the 2020 election, that came from Fox News and came from Gateway Pundit, and why that was important that he be able to express that in the classroom to engage in some degree of media literacy. So how much is the call for free speech a way to debunk theories, to debunk conspiracies, et cetera? And is that more effective than simply saying as an instructor, you know what, that's completely unmerited, there's no evidence of that whatsoever, let me just tell you, we're going to go in a different direction here because that one really doesn't have merit?
Well, that's a really important, in addition, really important norm in a college classroom, as well as in a K-12 classroom. We are here to advance knowledge, or on days when we want to be more grand, we're here to find truth, right? That's, you know, Mill's goal for us. And so I do think that sometimes, and particularly if an argument or a perspective has already been discussed and debunked in this classroom or more broadly, repeatedly, you know, it's clear that it has no merit. And here is this person again coming to advance something that they read on Twitter. You know, I do think that sometimes you can say, you know what, we've been there, we're not going there again. So I don't think we have to engage every single time that, you know, that somebody decides to demand again an answer to the same argument that we've heard. But I do think that generally speaking, and really reflecting back on Mill as you did, Doug, another reason that he's really calling on us to ensure that we have very broad boundaries for our discussions is not just because that allows us to find the truth, which is a very important argument, but also because sometimes when we hear competing arguments, it allows us to understand better why it is that we think what we think, why it is that we believe what we believe, right? Let's say that I have some opinion or view that I took for granted so far. And here you are thinking the opposite thing and advancing a case that I've never thought about. And maybe I still think is ridiculous or is misguided. But now I have to be accountable to myself, if not to you, by developing an argument for why it is that I still hold the same opinions that I do. And so that also advances my knowledge, right? Because now I know better something about my own perspective. And I also know that some people disagree with me. So, you know, so I have to be able to figure that part out too. And I think the boundaries of truth are the boundaries of the goals that we pursue. But they cannot initially be the boundaries of the process because we don't always know where we will get, right? We have to still do the work first. And even if you as the instructor already know where we're headed, you know, if you were just to tell us where we're going, we could have read that in a book. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need you and our peers and the classroom for that. We need that in order to develop the knowledge ourselves, right? I mean, that's the point of being in a class rather than just in front of a screen or, you know, a screen without people, right? Just reading a book, etc., which of course are also important ways of learning. But I think the face-to-face still has important contributions epistemologically, not only just because we're social animals. And so my sense about engaging with people who have misguided ideas, and sometimes I have to say, even bringing common misguided ideas into the classroom, if the students don't come up with them themselves, I think is a very important form of learning. You know, the public health program at my school decided at one point a couple of years back, you know, and I thought it was a very good idea to bring in a speaker who was opposed to vaccines and had an argument that was basically common anti-vaxxer argument. And so why is that a good thing to do? Because I think people who are part of the public health profession have to be able to hear these arguments, not just read them in a book, engage with a person, to read them in a book or on Twitter, right? Engage with a person who really believes whatever it might be that this person believed, and to be able to try and address that. I'm not trying to convince my public health students that they should oppose vaccines or that there is something wrong with the vaccines, right? Although this is, you know, of course, a scientifically open discussion, you know, specific dimensions of that. But the anti-vaxxer argument is already debunked, right? I'm not worried about its veracity, but I think it's sometimes still important to engage with it.
And that makes sense because we're trying to teach critical analysis and even being able to recognize certain arguments as you're presenting that. But what's interesting is we've had a tendency just in this conversation to talk more about the students themselves and are they able to express certain ideas, maybe speakers. But really at the top of the fears about cancel culture are actually we the instructors, especially since with technology, the likelihood that your class is going to be recorded is greater. Certainly, the pandemic meant we were all online and recording our classes, which could potentially change the content. And then one of the great fears I think we all face is the decontextualization of an argument, that you make an argument, if you're countering an argument, Lord help us if you're sarcastic or trying to be a bit funny, those can be taken out of context. And it's happened to a couple of my colleagues. And so at that stage, if we're living in an age of very short, bite-sized recordings that then get deconstructed and potentially decontextualized, how do we manage that and then keep our jobs or keep ourselves from being in the height of a huge crisis, a huge debate about whether or not you're worthy of continuing to teach, you know, your course?
Well, so I have to say that this is surely a concern. I will note that it is really a concern for our students as well. And I think many of them find themselves being silent in our classes for this same reason, right? And so I think this is a worry for us as teachers, and it's a worry for us as employees, right? Can I keep my job, you know, if somebody figures out a way to put words in my mouth or to decontextualize something I said, or even to make up a story about me? And we've seen in instances, for example, like at Hamline University, you know, when I'm actually doing my job effectively, productively, just the way that I'm expected to do. And here I am being fired nonetheless for doing that job, right? So because a student took it in the way that it shouldn't have been taken. So what I would say about that, it's not like I don't have a solution for that. But what I think we need to do has two parts, you know, that can maybe ameliorate some of that or alleviate some of this concern. One of them first is to try and develop trust, conditions of trust in the classroom and norms that are explicit and are enforced. You know, for example, you can say in your class, I'm asking you not to record me. I'm not allowing recording in my classrooms. And a lot of instructors are choosing to say that. It's not something that I'm doing, but it's partly because my students are older. So it's like a different dynamic. I think a lot of people who have big classes of undergraduates are doing that. And I think that's perfectly fine. I think it's very hard to have an open conversation when you're being recorded, right? And I think recording is problematic for the instructor in the way that you just said, but it's also problematic for the students, because what if a student is trying to work out an idea and then, you know, they say something, you know, they misspeak or they say something that can be interpreted, you know, in a negative light, or even they are hilariously wrong. I mean, doesn't it happen to all of us sometimes? How can you learn if you think that this, what you say now, is what you will be remembered for, you know, among your peers or on the internet, right? And so setting norms like not recording, trying to develop conditions of trust, as we talked before, things like that can make it a little bit less concerning. But most importantly, really, I think the job of countering this concern is the job of administration and leadership. I really have concerns, and the examples that we both gave are, you know, typical of that, that administrators and college or university leadership sometimes are very quick to just say, oh, this person said this terrible thing, off they go. If they don't have tenure, you know, and sometimes even if they do, they are out, right? It seems like in the moment, like the easiest path forward, right? They were being offensive, they were inappropriate, they are out. And I really think that this feeds the same frenzy, right? It feeds the same inclination to try and catch somebody, to try and, you know, get at them, rather than the more thoughtful discourse that we're trying to generate in class. And it also is really counter to the climate of open inquiry that they should, that administrators and college leadership and basically everyone who participates in this endeavor of developing and disseminating knowledge should take very seriously. So I just want to call for taking a deep breath before you take action because of something you saw on the internet.
The title of the book is Cancel Wars: How Universities Can Foster Free Speech, Promote Inclusion, and Renew Democracy.
When we come back, what are the implications of cancel culture on free speech, epistemology, and democracy? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How much is cancel culture a reaction to disempowerment and a means of resistance? And what has been the backlash to its success? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Joining Professor Sigal Ben-Poraf is Professor Eve. She is the associate professor at Ohio University in the School of Media Arts and Studies and the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program. She's the author of Cancel Culture, A Critical Analysis, and a forthcoming Mainstreaming Gaze, Critical Convergences of Queer Media, Fan Cultures, and Commercial Television. Thank you, Professor Ng, for joining us. In Cancel Culture, you talk about sort of the difference between cancel wars and cancel discourse and make a distinction between those two concepts. Could you explain the difference between those two?
So actually, I talk about cancel practices and cancel discourses, right? So cancel practices are what people are doing that we understand as canceling, what I call a cancel target. So a lot of this has to do with withdrawing support, and people can do that in lots of ways. Since canceling is so prevalent on social media platforms, it means no longer following someone. It means sometimes using hashtags, although my observation is actually that people no longer use cancel language as much, right? There used to be these hashtags, so-and-so is canceled, or the so-and-so person is over party. But I think people are still engaging in cancel practices to do with withdrawing support. Other things might happen offline, like I'm no longer buying particular kinds of products, although a lot of that is online as well. Sometimes it's to do with not watching shows or, you know, other media, consuming media associated with a cancel target. And at a more institutional level, we can think of cancel practices as literal canceling, right? So if someone gets their show canceled, like Roseanne Barr, or the show is continues without someone, that's also a form of canceling. So these are canceled practices. What I've also been really interested in, what I've called canceled discourses, which is what people are saying about what they call canceling or cancel culture or cancel events, mostly in a critical way, like criticizing cancel culture, because I think that that gives us a sort of a really interesting insight into, you know, who is making these statements and what are they saying about particular kinds of cancel events, and what are the responses from other people that engage in these kinds of cancel discourses.
So, Segal, this idea of a cancel discourse seems to fit pretty well with, you know, when we're talking about the impact of cancel on college campuses, university campuses, and what it means to cancel. I mean, in some cases, they might literally cancel a speaking event, but in a lot of cases, it's especially talking about professors, it's forms of protest, it's attacking reputation, you know, potentially don't take that class. That might be the practice, but then the discourse is, are you trying to shut somebody up?
Right. And I do think this is a very interesting distinction, and I think very useful. And it seems to me that for the most part right now, as Yves was just describing, for the most part, when we talk about canceling, we talk about it in pejorative ways, right? Judgmental or critical ways, right? So I think oftentimes people would say, oh, you're trying to cancel a person. That would not be a part of supporting this action, right? And so broadly speaking, at least what I observe on colleges seems to be that when we talk about cancel culture, we talk about people drawing boundaries about speech that we disapprove of, right? If I don't like the boundaries that someone is drawing, I will blame them that they are trying to cancel someone. Right? Whereas they might describe their actions as, for example, trying to prevent harmful speech, responding to an unacceptable view or opinion, trying to promote speech or events or other types of expression that are appropriate for college campus, and trying to prevent ones that they seem to think are inappropriate, right? So the way that a person would describe their own practices, right, using your language, Eve, would usually be more engaged, more substantive, and will not anymore include so much a depiction of canceling. Of course, as you were saying, the people are being still canceled in a practical way, right? Shows canceled, as you both said, events canceled. It's not happening a lot, right? Definitely not in colleges, but it's happening a little bit. And so we can talk about those, but the broader discourse is really a discourse about what do we see as the boundaries that need to be drawn around acceptable expression.
Now, Eve, in the earlier segment, one of the factors that we had talked about, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this as well, is how much the idea of canceling certain types of discourses, canceling certain types of messages, really has to do with a question about respect. That whether it's a question of the person being canceled, not having a respect for the community of which he or she, they have said something, or not having a respect if it's a political discourse for that position. And therefore, it's a vilification that's really derived from a lack of respect. Is that really at the core here? Question about the respect that we have for one another, for our ideas and for our discourses?
I think that's a really good question to ask. I'm coming to the topic from a somewhat different framework, which is interested much more in explicitly looking at power and differences in power. So I think we're pretty familiar with a critique of respectability politics, which says that whatever differences we have between us, we should always talk politely to each other, don't get too angry, definitely don't use abusive language or language that could be construed as like showing that you're getting upset, angry, right? And the critique has been, of course, that respectability is something that assumes kind of, fairly level playing field. If we talk in sort of more academic terms about Habermas's public sphere, that we're all just in a sort of public square, physical or much more commonly now digital, and that we just all need to be civil and listen to each other and everyone can express what they want. And then, if things will kind of wash out fairly evenly, right? But we know that's not how it works. And we know, for example, that there are gendered, racial, and other kinds of differences. And so part of what the history of cancel practices has shown us is that very powerful figures that used to, act with relative impunity could in fact be exposed and sometimes, but not usually, taken down by mass collective action online, right? So the Me Too movement, Harvey Weinstein, that kind of very prominent kind of case. I think what has happened though, from a progressive perspective, like as I talk about in the book, progressives have been criticized by conservatives for supposedly this like very broad cancel culture against the right. But progressives themselves, or I could say ourselves, since I would count myself as a progressive, have also been really concerned about the dynamics of cancel culture and how it's spread. So yes, of course, it would be good if everything was an even playing field and all we needed to do was show respect. But we've seen that actually sometimes collective action works because it doesn't take that kind of approach. It really is sort of saying, we want this person to go down and this is how we're going to do it. At the same time, we saw that something like Me Too filtered down to very ordinary people and filtered down in a way that people who had, for example, committed multiple or who'd been accused of multiple instances of sexual misconduct that was sexual assault and rape, right, were canceled. But someone who might have said something or done something problematic, but many of us would say not on the same scale, would also get canceled, right? So there was a kind of loss of scale. And so that's also, I think, a really important point to think about, more than I would argue respect as a judging point, but the scale of like how you're treating different kinds of misconduct or accusations of misconduct.
And Sigal, I think you have some thoughts on this as well.
I really think this is a very important perspective. And I think so it illuminates two things. I think one was explicit in what Eve was saying, which is really participating in a discourse is all very nice and good, but not everyone is able to speak or be heard in the same way, right? And so that's part of what Doug, you and I were talking about earlier in regards to the classroom and how to create the conditions where people really can participate. But these are not replicable in the general public sphere, right? And we know that people don't have the same volume, right? They don't have the same voice, the same capacity to speak and to be heard because of identity differences and other differences. But I also think that what this illuminates is another thing, which I think, was also at least evident to me in what he was saying, which is that part of what we're talking about here is really trying to advance a particular outcome, right? So when we talk about Harvey Weinstein and the women who were blaming him, of all of these awful acts that he was doing, the problem here is not just that he had a large voice or a lot of money or a lot of influence and they didn't. Of course, that's part of the problem. But another part of the problem is that they are right and he's wrong, right? So we're not trying to create here a discourse where his voice would be heard and their voice would be heard. And we would think together in a civil manner, is it good to assault women? You know, is it good to abuse them for advancing your own career or your preferences or your, you know, your tastes, etc.? Of course, that's not the conversation we're having. We're having a conversation where we're trying, as you said, to take a person down, right, in this case. But part of what we're trying to do is also to really enforce a certain norms about proper behavior. For example, not assaulting people, right, which, you know, is a pretty good plan and definitely superior to the other option. So I think, you know, the difficulty here is that there are instances where one side is right and the other side is wrong, period. And it's true legally, as in this case, and sometimes it's true normatively or in terms of the values. But there are cases where it's a little bit harder to know if we are all trying to, you know, if there is a correct goal that everyone should work towards, whether it's in a civil manner or in a different manner, right, more forceful, or whether really we need to air our differences that so that we can find out what is the correct course of action. And this is the challenge of democracy sometimes, right? I mean, you know, it's one of the challenges. When is collective action justified and trying to really mobilize other people and persuade and make sure that, you know, we listen to different perspectives? And when is it just no, you know, you're just misguided or criminally wrong or otherwise worthy of canceling, right? And again, the case of Me Too is a very difficult case, but it's easy in this regard, right? It's easy in the sense that I don't think there is any, I would claim that there is no argument on the other side. There is conduct, but there is no argument. Whereas in other instances, there are people who would say, this is definitely wrong. And others who would say, you know, let me try to convince you that whatever it is I'm claiming and you think is completely inappropriate and hateful is actually has some merit.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing cancel culture, cancel wars, cancel practices and discourses with Sigal Ben-Parath of the University of Pennsylvania and Eve Ng from Ohio University. So Eve, I think Sigal makes an important point. There's a difference between canceling somebody for what is criminal behavior. I mean, in the case of Weinstein, in the case of many of the Me Too, none of us want to have a debate about whether or not sexual assault is justified. That's one I hope that we have a consensus on. But ultimately, it seems like a lot of these cases, and in particular, a lot of contemporary cases are about things like the visibility, acceptance of the trans community, the support for same-sex marriage, for discourses on gun violence, et cetera, and this being central to a lot of the cancel discourses. I'm glad you brought in this issue of power, because a lot of the so-called cancel practices are from people who are largely powerless. And at the end of the day saying, well, at a minimum, I want to call you out on it. And if you happen to be selling something, I refuse to buy it. So ultimately, is some of the reason for this pushback against cancel culture is actually a pushback of the powerful against what's becoming an increasingly effective form of resistance.
I would argue that in the US context, that is true in many instances. So I talk about this in one of the chapters in my book about how conservative discourses in the US against cancel culture surged in 2020 in the wake of the George Floyd protests and in the wake of former President Trump's second impeachment trial. There was a lot of Republican use of cancel culture as kind of arguing that the left was wholesale trying to silence the right through cancel culture. One of Trump's lawyers for his impeachment trial, Michael Vandeveen, called the entire proceeding constitutional cancel culture, saying that, you know, it was trying to cancel not just Trump, but all of, you know, the 76 million people who voted for him. And so, yes, I think that is apparent. At the same time, both you and Segal make really important points about the fact that sometimes canceling isn't so straightforward. So you brought up trans rights. Of course, J.K. Rowling is the immediate figure we all think about. I would say she's been a very prominent cancel target by some, not even activists, just people who are aware of what she's said publicly about transgender people and the so-called biological basis of sexual identity. But as a gender and sexuality studies scholar, I think that she's deeply wrong. But do I think that she is not allowed to express those views? I mean, that is a different question, right? For a lot of trans rights activists, what she says constitutes hate speech, but not all gender and sexuality studies people, not all feminists agree with that. There is a strong, especially in the UK, a strong, I don't know if strong is the right word, but at least a prominent thread of feminism, gender critical feminists who agree with Rowling. And she's, I think, drawn a lot on their work. So, if we're talking about something that Segal brought up, like if it's like fascist, Nazi, eugenics kind of speech, that's one thing, right? Where we're saying, no, you can't say this entire race is superior to this other race and we should like exterminate them. We know that that's wrong, right? But what if it's this, right? What if it's about trans rights? There's not universal agreement. And I think that that does make things a lot trickier in, when we're trying to, if I come from a scholarly perspective and just I'm like, oh, what interesting cancel discourses we have, more fodder for my research. But also the sort of real world implications are we need policies on social media platforms, like what to allow, what to disallow. Elon Musk came in and like messed up Twitter in lots of ways, and Twitter was not perfect before him, like under Dorsey, but at least there was some kind of more consistent policy about what we allow, what we don't allow, right? There's a lot more discussion now by governments saying that social media platforms need to do better in policing their speech. And if they're not going to do it, especially, for example, in countries like New Zealand or in the European Union, more so than the US, because the US has this whole First Amendment issue that some countries don't have. So yeah, there's a lot of variation there as well.
Absolutely. And Segal, I think part of the issue here has to be with the way in which the issue gets framed, because it's one thing to have a very important discussion about trans rights, trans identity, what this means for feminism. I mean, even the questions about competitions and sports, I think there's potentially some really interesting conversations. That's qualitatively, distinctively different than we must, eliminate trans culture from our culture. The nature of the discourse matters. So the process of canceling J.K. Rowling, which is not a complete cancelization, I mean, she's still getting work. She's still, but it's people saying, I don't want to give her any money. I don't want to buy her books. I don't want to watch, those shows, actually has triggered a really interesting, at least potentially triggered a really interesting conversation about trans identity. So is the process of canceling actually helping to move forward some of our discourse, or is the problem we really like our discourse to come in bite-sized morsels that can fit inside of a tweet?
Well, so I think the discussion around Rowling's expression regarding women and trans women, etc., really, to some extent, has made the debate on the topic more visible. And in this way, it might have made trans people more visible, which I think is a positive in this regard. But that has generated also another backlash against them through legislation, et cetera, which is really trying to eliminate not only just the visibility of trans people in the culture in various ways, but also really to try to eliminate the capacity of people to be trans, right? So We are seeing in Missouri, for example, the legislation that doesn't allow for minors to be, and in certain instances also adults, to be receiving gender-affirming care. This is now not about canceling regarding speech, as in Rowling's, or even purchasing, using my purchasing power, but it's really restricting the freedom of people to live the way they would like to live, and the way that, to express themselves the way that they see themselves. So my sense is that part of the problem is, and I think Eve was really helpful in trying to unpack that, part of the problem is that all of these different aspects are being basically collapsed into each other. Is the problem what a person, even a famous person, saying about people? Is the question that we are having a question around facts, for example, facts regarding the expression of gender or the differences between sex and gender, facts about the impact on gender-affirming care on young people, and how do we assess that? So these are questions of fact. There are questions of values. Some people just don't, you know, like the fact that trans people exist, and that's their value. That's a different thing, which I think is, you know, has a different level of unacceptability, right? And then there is the legislative decisions, which are again a separate thing, right? So I think we cannot resolve all of these things by trying to legislate them away or create policies that will anchor them in some way that would eliminate other perspectives, whether supportive of trans folks or otherwise. I think what we need to try and do is to understand where are some areas where we can maybe find common ground or a shared goal in regards to the policies that we institute, try to identify and enact those. That seems to me a more promising route, although some days I'm not optimistic even about that.
Eve, I'll ask you then last question, inspired by Sigal talking about, you know, what are the most promising routes in addressing these issues. What would you most like to see change or continued in our discourses about canceling? Are we on the right track, or does there need to be some change in the way that we approach these issues, approaching people saying things that, you know, being able to differentiate between that needs to be canceled, that's hateful, that's potentially inviting violence, versus that's a difference of opinion?
Well, earlier you were saying, you were asking, are we now a culture that, you know, prioritizes basically being able to express something in the brevity of a tweet? Before social media, already people had been concerned about the decreasing lack of attention, right? Every new form of media has generated these anxieties. Certainly radio, television, like when MTV came along, people were like, oh no, like now the kids will only be able to focus for like the length of a music video, like 3 or 4 minutes. And now that seems really long. Like, I'm very aware of like watching videos and I'm like, is it over yet? And it hasn't even been 1 minute, right? Yes, but we are often losing, I think, we have lost a lot of nuance in public debate because of the brevity of expression on social media. So that's one thing. And it doesn't help that so much canceling happens on those very platforms, right? The platforms whose affordances militate against nuanced debate is where a lot of this is happening. But if we can step back from those spaces, and if we're asking ourselves, yeah, what do we want to do about the fact that canceling is happening to different targets in a lot of different contexts for different reasons, then I think that there is no one single answer, right? The answer is that we need to look at the specificities of each case. And that's hard, right? So if you are a social media platform, for example, Twitter or some other platform, you can't just have a blanket. I mean, every time they have a blanket anything, it doesn't work, right? So for example, several years ago, YouTube redid its algorithm to supposedly prevent, like, I think too much sexually explicit content getting monetized, but it was found to disproportionately affect queer content creators who weren't producing sexually explicit stuff at all, but the algorithm was just, you know, looking for words like, you know, lesbian, gay, and so on, and like demonetizing those channels, right? Similarly, when you look at certain kind of automatic content moderation software or algorithms, there's always something that isn't quite right. But when you have that volume of content on a social media platform, some of it has to be automated. And maybe, you know, this new generation of AI will help. Maybe it will make it worse. But I think that ideally, these kinds of spaces, whether we're talking about social media platforms or going back to what Sagal was, I think, talking about earlier, like universities, ideally there is actually some kind of committee or some kind of, you know, governance body that will look at these cases, will can do some examination on a case-by-case basis, or at least to have some policies that aren't just all or nothing. Because the all or nothing has never worked and it still is not working.
We've been discussing cancel wars, cancel culture, cancel practices, cancel discourses with our guests. Our first, Sigal Ben-Purath. She's professor of education at the University of Pennsylvania, holds secondary appointments in the departments of philosophy and political science. Most importantly, she's just published a new book. It's called Cancel Wars: How Universities Can Foster Free Speech, Promote Inclusion, and Renew Democracy. She's also the author of Making Up Our Mind: What School Choice is Really About and Free Speech on Campus. And Professor Eve Ng, Associate Professor at Ohio University in the School of Media Arts and Studies and the Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Program. She's the author of Cancel Culture, A Critical Analysis, and a forthcoming Mainstreaming Gaze, Critical Convergences of Queer Media, Fan Cultures, and Commercial Television. Thank you both very much for joining us and sharing your insights.
Thank you so much, Deb. It was a pleasure to talk to you and to Eve.
Thank you to Doug and Sagal.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.